Hello and welcome to another edition of Living with Dying. Today's episode is slightly different from most, and I suppose I probably should put a trigger warning ahead of it because we are going to be talking about assisted dying, and we're going to be talking about someone who has very recently died and actually wanted to record her own death. So that's the subject of today's episode. We're talking to Kai Emmons' husband, who was with her when she decided to take her own life, and has very kindly agreed to talk to me about his wife and her life. She got the terrible degenerative disease ALS, and that must have made life very difficult for her, and Paul's going to tell us all about it. But I thought I ought to say at the top that we call this assisted dying, and it's a subject that's a really hot topic in the UK at the moment. It's being debated in Parliament. But I think what's really interesting about Kai is that she really wanted to open up the subject, didn't she, and show people what it was like and documented her decline. Anyway, Paul, why don't you tell me a bit more about Kai Emmons?
Well, as you mentioned, she was a writer, a novelist. She wrote short stories, fiction, almost exclusively. And we met at a writer's conference in 1993 and became fast friends. And then in 2004, we became more than that. We became entangled, as it were, and moved in together. And we were both writers. I was writing fiction then, but then I turned to writing plays. And so we had a wonderful life together. Kai wrote every morning in bed, longhand, using a pen and a pad. And I would serve her coffee in the morning and then leave her alone so she could write in the mornings. She had a very successful career as a writer up until the moment she died, actually. And so, as you say, it was kind of a project of hers to bring this topic of not only assisted dying, but also what it means to be dying and how to live while you're dying. She wanted to bring the topic of death to her friends and family and her readers, and wanted to kind of demystify the whole topic. And she did. I think she did it very admirably and courageously.
Yeah, I was just going to say a very brave thing to do, because she's basically, and you both are actually basically on display throughout the whole of this documentary, aren't you? And I should name it. It's called Vanishing, A Love Story, which is a very nice play on the word ALS, isn't it?
It's right. A love story.
Yeah, absolutely. But yes, we see her as she was. We see her almost fully healthy, don't we? And then we observe the very tragic decline. Tell me more about what happened to her.
So around the year 2020, she started noticing some difficulty speaking. At first, she had trouble saying consonants. She noticed it first when she was giving a reading in the San Francisco Bay Area, and she felt like she was having trouble pronouncing some consonants. And she would say words to me, and it sounded normal to me. I couldn't discern any difference in the way she was speaking, but she definitely felt it. And so she started exploring what it was, what was causing this trouble speaking. She thought maybe her teeth were moving, and so she got a retainer. Then later, as the difficulty progressed and I was able to hear it clearly, she started seeing doctors to figure out what was going on. Myasthenia gravis was a possible diagnosis that she explored. And then as it got worse, her speaking got worse, then she started talking to a neurologist who did tests. And at first, they didn't think it was ALS. But I think what we learned through the whole process of the diagnosis and the progression of the illness is that doctors always want to rule out the most dire diagnosis. And so they were looking for all kinds of diagnoses other than ALS. In fact, Kai had a test where they poked electrodes into her body all over the place, including up through under her chin and into her tongue to get, you know, to emit electrical impulses and get the results from that. And she had that test done, and the doctors here in Eugene, Oregon said, no, you don't have ALS. But then we went to an esteemed medical institution in Portland, OHSU, and they ran the same tests. And, you know, the disease had progressed more by then, and so she was diagnosed. And then almost immediately, well, there's a kind of a funny story where we get this bad news at OHSU. It's about a two-hour drive from where we live in Eugene. And then we were devastated. We were crying in the doctor's office after the diagnosis. The doctors were crying. They told us how the treatment would go and how they would monitor at their clinics every 3 months and see how the disease was progressing. And then they let us go home. And so we had this two-hour drive back home. And Kai was calling her friends and letting them know. And then we were passing this mall that Kai knew of. And she said, let's go shopping. And so we pulled off, and there was a store that she liked to go to. And we were browsing in the store. I picked out a candle. She picked out a top that she wanted to buy, and we took them to the counter. And the clerk at the counter said, so, how is your day going? And we both suppressed laughter at that. But that kind of set the tone for the rest of the next 2 years with Kai. Really trying to live a full life and a meaningful life while, you know, having this terminal illness.
It must have been so hard for both of you facing up to the fact that there was no good answer. There was no good resolution.
There was no resolution. I mean, there was a given resolution. It was going to resolve in Kai's death. So a friend of ours at the time, still my friend, had been battling cancer, and she brought up the fact that when you have cancer, I mean, there's a chance that you'll beat it, you'll survive. With ALS, there's no chance. It's a foregone conclusion. And so, yeah, it was pretty devastating. I think I'm trying to recall back to the first few days. Well, we decided then we'd been living together. This was in 2021, and we'd been living together since 2004, had never been married. And so we decided immediately that we were going to get married. And so 10 days later, there we were on Valentine's Day, tying the knot in the rainy Oregon weather out on our patio under some canopies. And I think maybe that really did set the tone for how we would proceed in the span of her illness progressing. We were going to live life with all the fullness, all the gusto that we could muster.
And that's very obvious in the documentary. She's obviously such a positive person. Well, you both must be. But can I just ask you to just stop you a bit and just, do you recollect whether the grief started straight away? Because I'm kind of thinking it must have done.
Well, the grief was immediate and powerful, yeah, for both of us. And grief management was something we had to accomplish throughout the 2 years of her illness. We didn't want it to dominate us. I certainly didn't have time to let it dominate me, even though I was silently grieving the whole time. But as her primary caregiver, you know, in the first year, I had to learn some nursing skills. And then in the second year, I really did have to take care of her on a daily basis. So having that responsibility meant that I couldn't have a pity party and just kind of give up and mourn. I mean, I think rather than grieving, I was actively mourning the situation and mourning her loss even before she died. I mean, almost immediately. But I couldn't let it control me because of my responsibilities, and she couldn't let it control her because she had all these projects. She had all these things she wanted to accomplish before she died.
Were you able to share that, or did you kind of protect each other?
We shared everything. She and I were so open with each other, and that's one of the things that drew us together in the first place, was the fact that we were so honest with each other and open. And if we were angry, if we were sad, and especially if we were happy, we would share that without any restriction. So yeah, there were moments that you wouldn't see in the film, where Kai was depressed or angry or sad, and as well as me. But I think I hit it better than she did.
So let's talk about the documentary then. What was it, do you think, inspired her to want to do that? And how did you feel about it?
Well, she'd struck up a friendship with Sandra Luca, the director of the film. At first, it was not intended to be a film. Sandra lives in New York, but she is from Oregon originally, and she was coming out to Oregon to see family and whatnot. And Kai had been diagnosed already. And Sandra said, "How would you feel if I came and met you in person," which they had never met in person, "and shot some video so that your family could have this as after you die?" And Kai was great. Yeah, let's do that. And when the way Sandra recalls it, when she showed up the first day at our house, Kai handed her a shot list of everything that she needed to film. And it became apparent immediately that this was going to be a documentary. And this was wonderful for Kai. I would almost say that it was a distraction, but it was more than that. It was a real project for her to sink her teeth into, because both Kai and Sandra had gone to the NYU film school, and Kai was a screenwriter, a film editor before she became a novelist. And she loved film. And so this was something that she could really sink her teeth into and be a participant in. And she loved every moment of having Sandra in our house with her iPhone in our faces. She filmed the whole documentary on her iPhone. But we were so involved in our daily routine that we hardly noticed Sandra in the room with us. I mean, if she'd had a big old camera, you know, maybe it might have been different, but she was definitely the fly on the wall. We had developed a friendship with her. So it was like having a friend there just snapping photos or taking video. You know, after a while, you don't think about it. So it gave Kai another thing to do. I mean, she was writing a novel at the time. She was writing her blog at the time, in which she talked extensively about her illness and about death and about living while dying. And so the film was just, a wonderful way for Kai to be creative among these other things that she was doing. The only time that, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but the only time that I didn't feel comfortable about the filming was at the actual moment when Kai took her life-ending drugs, the actual death. I felt that that was, I felt too vulnerable. I thought it was too private and intimate, but Kai wanted it to be filmed, and so we filmed it. Unfortunately, Sandra couldn't make it in time to film it herself, so we filmed it on Zoom. But it shows everything, including administering the drugs, her kind of closing her eyes, me and the other family members and friends being around her as she's unconscious and dying. And then afterwards, the moments afterwards, after she has passed, then it shows all of that. It doesn't really pull any punches. It shows pretty much all of it.
I felt so bad for you during that. I have to say, I thought, poor man, you were having to help. You weren't allowed to help fully, were you? She had to administer some of the drugs herself.
Yes, it's a requirement of the laws here in Oregon that the patient administer the drugs themselves. And so at that point, for quite a while, for over a year, Kai had a feeding tube, and she had to administer the drugs through the feeding tube. I was able to stabilize the syringes that contained the drugs, but she had to press the plunger. And I've watched the film a number of times now at various screenings and at festivals. And every time that's shown at the very beginning of the film, The Death with Dignity. And every time I can't hold the tears back. I mean, it's so devastating. And then it shows a moment where after Kai has died and everybody has left the room but me, I just kind of spontaneously crawled into bed with her, and I held her for a couple of hours. And you can see through the time-lapse photography, you can see the sky getting dim through the window. And I just didn't want to let go. It was the hardest thing.
Does it give you comfort to have a recording of that now or not?
Well, that particular part of it, maybe not. But every time I do see the film, I am delighted, overjoyed to spend an hour and a half with Kai. To hear her speaking, because there are videos of her, with her full speaking voice, at various occasions. And then even during the illness, how much fun we had doing various things, going to the clinic, going shopping. I just love reliving a lot of that. And also Sandra used some footage, some video that I shot of our trips to the San Juan Islands in Washington State. We would go every year, at least once a year, to Lopez Island, and we rented a house right on the water. She would write in the morning, and then we would go kayaking and bike riding and hiking, and we'd fix wonderful meals all through her illness. And there is a video that I shot of her paddling her kayak in the bay. And it's such a strong mix of emotions, both overwhelming joy and overwhelming sadness. I can cry or laugh or just feel joy while watching that video, because she loved it so much. We loved it together so much.
I can sense her enthusiasm through you. It comes through you.
Mm. Yeah.
So, Paul, how on earth did you look after yourself during this period? And did you have any help and support for yourself?
I did. I had, we have quite a network of friends here in Eugene. We have lots of family, not in the area per se, but so I did rely on friends to come and stay with Kai, be with Kai, and took that opportunity to kind of do things for myself, take a break from having to administer her medications. And that I even, she had infusions that took place 10 days out of every month. And so I had to access the port in her chest with a needle, and that was very stressful. Mm. It was actual nursing that I should have had a degree for. But so, I mean, there was a lot of stress trying to do things right. And as Kai's illness progressed, the things that worked before started not working. So I'd have to learn new ways of doing things. So there was a lot of pressure, but our friend group here in Eugene were just so present and available to help out with Kai, and they were coming over constantly. And, you know, we would go to friends a lot while Kai was still pretty active and mobile. And her family from across the country came to Eugene often to spend a week at a time. Her sisters and their families, friends from all over the country would come. And because, I mean, it was pretty obvious. It was no question that her life was ending soon. And so people just made an effort to come out and stay with us. And I did, you know, take time off during those visits.
I mean, the cruelest thing about the disease seems to be the way you lose one function after another, don't you? That must have been terrible for her and terrible for you to witness.
Particularly horrible for Kai because of the type of ALS she had, which is bulbar onset ALS, which affects the throat first, the throat and breathing apparatus. And so she lost her ability to speak before anything else. And Kai was a great conversationalist. She loved to talk. She loved to talk with her girlfriend. She liked to talk with interviewers. She just talk. And so to lose that ability right off the bat was very cruel. So she had to learn how to use speaking devices, text-to-speech, using her phone or her computer. And that really slowed down her ability to speak, right? So that was probably the worst symptom to begin with. And then slowly, with bulbar onset ALS, slowly the limbs start to be affected. It's a faster progressing illness than, or form of the illness, than limb onset ALS, which people can survive with for years and years. I think, you know, all the famous people we know that have had ALS, usually it's, and have lived for a long time, it's usually limb onset. But once her limbs started to be affected, then it was a fairly steep and rapid decline. Then she was stubborn, and she would not use a walker. First, she wouldn't use a cane, And then she fell a couple of times. And so, you know, she would use a cane, but she didn't want to use a walker. And she fell a couple of more times. One time she got a big black eye as she was trying to get into the hot tub and fell and hit her head. And oh, it was horrible. Another time she was walking past the commode in the bathroom, lost her balance. I think she did have her walker at this point. She fell over backwards, hit her head on the commode, broke the seat, and ended up with a huge knot on the back of her head. But then eventually there was no avoiding the walker, and she had to, I think that was the incident that turned the tide on that one. So when she got to the point where she could just barely walk, we knew that the time was getting short.
It must have been so hard for someone who was so positive, and as you say, so stubborn to think about letting go in this particular way. But I guess on the other hand, you were quite fortunate in where you lived, weren't you? Because she was able to choose the way her life would end, and not many people get that choice.
Yes, we were very lucky to be here, and I can't imagine the agony that people must go through, knowing that they're going to be dying with a terminal illness and not being able to do anything about it, and knowing that they've reached the limit of their productive lives, as Kai had. I mean, in preparing for our talk today, I was remembering something that the American philosopher James Rachels wrote about an essential part of being human is the projects that we undertake. And when we can no longer participate in those projects, our life diminishes just so dramatically. And for Kai, she had these three projects that she was so engaged in her life: her final novel that she was writing, the film, and her blog posting, and some other projects having to do with not settling scores, but kind of coming to a conclusion with all of her relationships and that sort of thing. But once she knew that she couldn't write anymore, that she couldn't even type anymore, that she would have to use the eye gaze device to speak, and couldn't eat, couldn't breathe on her own, that for her was the line in the sand. I don't want to live anymore. And because I've lived out the purpose of my life. And on the morning of the day that she ended her life, she submitted the manuscript of her final novel to her agent that morning. I mean, she was working up until the very end. She'd been working on this novel for quite a while. And at a certain point, she determined that she would die on her birthday, which was January 15th. And so she thought she had until the 15th to submit her novel to her agent. But an unfortunate series of events occurred on New Year's Eve, 2020-2021. Her feeding tube fell out, and because she was on hospice, we couldn't go to the hospital to have it replaced. And the hospice people were trying to find somebody in their ranks who could reinsert the feeding tube. I couldn't do it. And so we had to wait a couple of hours to get permission from hospice to go to the hospital to have them reinsert the tube. Well, it was the worst experience we'd ever had at the emergency room. Maybe because it was New Year's Eve, I don't know. But the doctor couldn't get her feeding tube back in. By that time, the hole was closing up. It happens very rapidly. And so then not to bore you with the details of this, but a surgeon came in and tried to widen the hole with some forceps without any anesthetic. And it was just a horrible, I called it clown hospital. It was so horrible. And so we got home early on New Year's Day, and I put Kai to bed, and she looked at me and she said, "I can't wait till the 15th. I'm done. This is too hard, and I'm ready to go." So we determined that she would end her life on the next day, when we had planned for a final visit from friends. We had invited a bunch of people. It was kind of an open house. People would come and stay, you know, sit in our living room, and person by person, they would go into the bedroom to say goodbye to Kai, which I thought was a lovely thing to do. But so things changed. On that day, the second, she decided to end her life. So we had to call off the visitation. We had to contact her sisters, who had to fly overnight. And Kai, that day, New Year's Day, had to finish her manuscript. She had to get it ready to send to her agent. And she was all about writing.
How was she doing it at that stage?
She was doing it on the computer, like hunting and pecking, because she couldn't type anymore, to write the email to her agent to create the final PDF of her manuscript and all of that, make some final changes, final edits to the manuscript, and then sending it off, not knowing if the agent would want to represent it, not knowing if it would ever be sold or published. And it was just published 2 years after her death.
And that brings us very nicely to the point where I wanted to end. I wanted to ask you about it. It's called The Bells.
It's called The Bells, yes.
Published in the US. Is it published in the UK as well? Do you know?
I don't think that's a UK publisher, but it's probably available online. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, so,
you tell me about it.
It's a fascinating novel. Kai was very interested in a couple of things as she started writing this novel. She was interested in the concept of evil because of the political and social climate of the United States and really across the world these days. There's maybe a lot of evil being perpetrated, evil in many different forms. And for instance, she thought that the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the abortion law, was cruel, was evil. And so she was thinking about evil and what situation, what story she could tell about that, about that would involve evil. And also at our niece's wedding, we went to Denver for a week, and the groom's brother happened to be a priest. And Kai was fascinated with, I mean, she was not Catholic, but and I was raised Catholic, so I knew that priests had social lives and regular normal lives as well. But she was fascinating with seeing this priest interacting with family and at this wedding and whatnot. And so those two kind of obsessions of hers formed into this story. And the story is about a character named Niall O'Malley, who is 30-something-year-old school teacher in New Jersey. He has decided to become a teacher after being a monk for 5 years and suddenly abruptly leaving the monastery and the order to live a different kind of life. The thing that forced him out of the monastery was this contentious, violent, sometimes violent relationship that he had with another monk, Brother Thomas. And so the whole event of the novel is Niall coming to terms with his loss of faith, wanting to have faith, dealing with this, what he considers evil, monk having an unresolved relationship with that monk, and then not having success as a teacher, and the bells are just tolling for him. You know, they're just like, okay, what am I going to do to make my life right?
Well, thank you ever so much for talking to me, Paul, about Kai and your relationship and your life. Can I end by saying, how are you now?
I am good. Thank you for asking. In the last, I would say, 6 to 8 months, have turned a real corner, and I have integrated this grief that I feel into my daily life. The joy I have remembering Kai is just as strong, if not stronger, than that grief. Of course, as you probably well know, at any moment, at any day, the grief can strike out of the blue. And, you know, I have a moment of real, real deep sadness. But in the last 6 or 8 months, I have been living my life fully and enjoying the memories I have with Kai. Because at the beginning, in the first, particularly 6 months, I couldn't have any memory of Kai without it causing pain. And for a long time, that was the case, that when I remembered Kai, when I remembered things that we did together, when I saw photographs, the pain would be overwhelming. Kai asked that we remember her with joy. And it's taken me a while, but I do always now remember her with joy.
Oh, that's really good to hear. Thank you so much, Paul, for talking to me. Oh, and we mustn't forget to mention The Bells is published now, and the documentary is called Vanishing, A Love Story, and it should be coming to London sometime soon, which is brilliant. Thank you so much, Paul, for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.